What we're gonna do right here is go back, way back, back into time.
This is Butch Slaughter, and you're listening to the Echoes of Indiana Avenue. Welcome to my neighborhood, the Avenue. I grew up here, and each week I'll be sharing the sounds and stories of the people that made the Avenue great. Welcome back to the Avenue. This is the first episode in our three-part series, paying tribute to Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign, one of the most legendary bands in Naptown music. The group formed in the late 1960s and began performing as the Ebony Rhythm Band. The Ebony Rhythm Band played some of their earliest gigs on the Avenue and became the house band for the Indianapolis soul music label Lamp Records. During the early 1970s, they left Naptown for California and released their debut album as the Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign in 1973. Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign achieved their greatest success during the 1970s. They performed with some of the biggest stars in American music, like B.B. King, Earth, Wind & Fire, Isaac Hayes, and Jackie Wilson. And their recordings received serious airplay, even appearing on Billboard's R&B Hot 100 chart. Today, Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign remain a cult favorite with soul music fans around the world. And last year, the group had new releases on labels in London, England, and Tokyo, Japan. Stay tuned for an hour of words and music with three of the band's founding members, Pam Tanner Davis, Ricky Jackson, and Lester Johnson. Let's start this week's show with a track from the new Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign album, 69 Cents. This is Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign with I'm in a Hurry.
Live inside my baby, yeah.
Feel something not too great. Yes, I did. The next thing I knew,
I jumped straight to my feet. Oh,
that was the Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign with I'm in a Hurry. WFYI's Kyle Long recently spoke with three of the group's founding members, vocalist Pam Tanner Davis, keyboardist Ricky Jackson, and bassist Lester Johnson. Let's join their conversation.
I'm Lester Lammy Johnson.
I'm John Ricky Jackson.
And I'm Pam Tanner Davis, lead vocalist for Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign.
Thank you all so much for being here today. Okay. I've interviewed you all individually, but this is the first time I've interviewed the group, the core members of the group collectively. And, you know, this group changed a lot through the years, but you are all sort of the backbone of the group. And I did want to start off by asking about someone who's not here today. The legendary drummer Matthew Watson, a founding member of this group, and a just such an essential part of the group's sound, passed away a couple years ago. I wanted to give you a chance to talk about Matthew, what he added to this band, any thoughts you want to share about Matthew.
Well, he was our drum machine. He was an incredibly gifted guy. I mean, He literally just was constantly creating grooves and music and stuff. But it wasn't just beats and stuff. Matthew was all, he would take those things that everybody didn't pay any attention to. Like, he'd take milk crates and he made a light system out of milk crates. He would even attempt to make, I think he made some shoes once, remember those
pilgrim
shoes?
He probably did.
He made shoes and sandals and things out of leather. Yeah. He made some of his own clothing. Matt was just an incredibly creative person. So for us, he was a huge part of our sound. He really was.
Definitely.
He also was a one-of-a-kind for me. Mm-hmm. He was a one-of-a-kind because we met drummers and saw drummers perform for years all over the country. But we never saw another Matthew. We never heard another Matthew. He was like a one-of-a-kind, you know, that you just didn't see very often or if ever. Yeah. Okay, yeah. And I know sometimes when I would introduce the band, I would always call him the captain of our ship. He loved that, too, by the way. Yeah. Because he spearheaded the whole funk thing we had going, you know. He was the basis for it all. Yeah.
Yeah, he always said he wanted to take and play drums like a musical instrument. Right. And that's why he played the way he did. It wasn't just, mm-hmm. I'll play 2-4-1-1. Yeah, well, I'm playing 2-3-4-5. You know, I'm trying to play some notes. And at times you could hear him humming along while we played the melodies in the songs. He just wanted to be part of the melodical portion of the song. That's why he was so creative and why his sound was so different than anybody else. Mm-hmm. He could play the straight stuff, but most of the time it was, hey, we're going to syncopate, we're going to do this, I'm going to, you know, be all over the place. So yeah, he was very important to the sound of the band. Mm-hmm. He really was.
Lester, you always refer to him as a drum machine and his ability to conceive rhythmic patterns.
He really was. Matthew had an extreme sense of timing. He had Rolex timing. And so sometimes as a bass player, I'll be honest, in the early days it was a bit difficult for me because he would use a lot of his marching band rudiments. And in the early days, I had to stay out of his way.
Right.
Because you know how he would do.
I know he would. Yeah. He would just be all over the place.
He would
sometimes. You play the backbeat every now
yeah,
and then.
Yeah,
we would be
looking for a simplified backbeat.
Right.
And Matthew would play a series of paradiddles and flams and everything. And so... So at first, in the early days, it was really kind of difficult. That was when we were the Ebony Rhythm Band. We morphed, and it was even Matthew's idea to call the band the Funk Campaign.
Right.
Yep.
Because we were in the middle of a legal thing, and we were going to sign for another record deal. We were connected to Herb Miller through Ebony Rhythm Band. So we couldn't sign a new record deal under that name. So Matthew was the one that came up with the Funk Campaign.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It was his idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. You talked about the unique style he had, especially on those early records, which is, I love it personally. You can hear it on the Vanguards records that you guys played
right,
on.
Yeah.
Of course, you can hear it on the records you made under the name Ebony Rhythm Band. His sound at that time was just so dominating. And he expressed some regret about that when I spoke with him a couple years ago. He realized that maybe it was over the top. But that's
busy.
As a fan, what I loved about it was it was just so in your face. And it was so powerful. I'm curious, with such a powerful drummer, how hard is it for you guys to kind of continue on in his absence? Has this been something that's been... I mean, as a person, obviously, he left a huge impact on your lives. But as a musician, he was such a key part of the sound. How difficult was it for you to go on without him?
As a group, it's hard. As individuals, I think it's a little less hard, mainly because the group actually kind of disbanded in the early 80s. So we have all been working as... individually as musicians, so we've had to adapt to playing with drum machines, drummers, sequencers, foot stompers, whatever. We've had to adapt to all of that. But when the group comes together, it is very difficult because Matthew was just such an integral part of what we did.
We will never create the same music.
No,
never. That's what we got. Is you better. That's going to be it. But for us to bring a drummer or somebody in to try to give the feel and the stuff that we do, I don't think we're going to see ourselves doing that type of
no
So at that point, that's why we're trying to, you know.
Yeah. Well, Dwayne Garvin was the drummer that, actually, there were a few people in the middle of that, Larry Beans, mm-hmm. that was short-lived. But Dwayne Garvin became the drummer for the Funk Campaign after Matthew, because Matthew left the group, but he didn't become dormant. He had his own group, Epoxy, and he was playing with a number of other people. He was doing a lot of other things, too. Mm-hmm. But Dwayne wasn't actually, even though he was very different stylistically from Matthew, he was really very good, very creative, but he Absolutely. Was different from Matt. But the sound we had with Matt was, I don't know how I don't think we can recreate that.
Just compare the two albums.
Yeah, the two albums.
Right. Right. That's all you have to do.
That's why I said, Rabbit, this is a completely different kind of music.
Yeah, they're both good.
But they're both excellent pieces of music.
They're both very, good,
very, very different.
Yeah, because I kind of felt the same.
Watching Me, Watching You, right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, the second album. I was going to say, I kind of felt the same way about our guitar player, about Master Booby. To this day, I still find myself comparing other guitar players to him. And I have to catch myself and say, no, because he's gone. There is no other one. There is no other Master Booby. And I have to stop comparing other guitar players to him, because he also had a unique style, too, that it's, I mean, all guitar players that I talk to right now are still talking about Master Booby and his style and how they just, you know, just wish they could play like he played, you know. So I still find myself comparing all guitar players to the way Master Booby played as well.
Mm-hmm. In 2018, WFYR's Kyle Long spoke with Ebony Rhythm's drummer and co-founder Matthew Watson. Let's listen to an excerpt of their conversation as Watson recalls how the Ebony Rhythm Band evolved from the Golden Souls Show Band.
I played with Harvey Cook and a lot of the different guys. And the first band that I really spent any time with was the Golden Souls Show Band. We had a bass player named Jimmy Williams. But what happened with him, he wanted to be a lead singer because he could sing good. And that's how Lester ended up getting in. And Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign was the name I came up with. One day, I was looking at the Ebony magazine, and I mean, things were so distorted in those days. We carried an Ebony magazine to school. The teachers thought it was a pornography magazine. They didn't even know that African American people were publishing magazines. But a lot of the kids in the neighborhood had Jet, because those magazines weren't on magazine racks. They weren't even sold in stores. People went around from door to door and sold those magazines. The first gig that we really had was called The Flame.
Flame.
And it was a transvestite joint that had live music. And we played behind the different shows, and plus we played, and me, Lester, Ricky, and Master Booby, because that was the original group.
Let's pause and listen to the Ebony Rhythm Band's debut single, released by Lamp Records in 1969. This is Soul Heart Transplant.
Thank you.
That was the Ebony Rhythm Band with their debut single, Soul Heart Transplant, released by Lamp Records in 1969. Let's return to our conversation with Ebony Rhythm's Pam Tanner Davis, Ricky Jackson, and Lester Johnson.
Yeah, you are all such unique instrumentalists and gave this incredible sound to the band. And it's a sound like no other group, you know. It's a really distinct sound. How would you describe the group sound? Ebony Rhythm Band, Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign?
You mean then or now?
Just in
Through the years, I think the group was... one of the things I remember the most about our whole thing from the beginning, we were influenced by a lot of other influences, some of the other local bands. And for an example, we were just as much into rock almost and to other kinds of music as we were into R&B. In fact, we really didn't want to be like the other bands. There was another organization here called DP, Designated Production. Yeah. And all that they had these bands, and they all wore these little outfits, matching outfits. And to us, that was corny. We were like, man, they look like little monkey suits, don't they? We didn't want to do that.
That was a style then. But we didn't want to do it, but that was a style.
No, we didn't want to do that.
Absolutely was. Right.
And they do now.
Because you have to remember, it was during the time of the singing group craze, the Delphonics.
Right. And all the guys dressed up.
And they all dressed like that.
Right.
Except but we didn't want to do that.
We wanted to be different.
We took a left turn.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, they were all listening to what somebody else did. We were riding down the highway listening to Led Zeppelin and Steppenwolf,
Buddy Miles, Chicago,
Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Yeah, BS&T. We were more interested in, honestly, in what they were doing than we were some of the other R&B around here, because we felt that most of the R&B around here was redundant and it had been done over and over again. They were just replicas of replicas of replicas of a replica. And we didn't want to be another replication that would be ignored. And we weren't either. They didn't ignore us because we were different.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've talked to you a lot about that in the past, Lester, the group being nonconformists and kind of forging your own sound and visual image within the Indianapolis music scene. And really, on a national level, you were one of the first black psychedelic rock bands in the country. You were getting this off the ground, I think maybe a little before George Clinton really launched what Funkadelic eventually became.
Almost simultaneously, because when we were in Boston, I know you guys don't remember this, playing
at
Izzy Ort's Golden Nugget.
Yep.
And we were playing there, and we were in the same hotel as the Parliament Funkadelic.
They were playing at the Sugar Shack.
Right. They were playing Sugar Shack. Mm-hmm. We were playing at the Golden Nugget. They put us out of the hotel because of the antics that the Parliament Funkadelic were doing on the upper floors or above us. They were having these wild parties and throwing mattresses out the window and running up and down the hallway with diapers on and all kind of stuff. We thought we were wild, but when we saw these guys, we were like, man, we ain't wild at all.
Yeah. They were around, but they were, at that time, they were still basically an underground band.
Right.
Because they wouldn't play them on mainstream radio. So you would only hear them on, like, the college radio stations or something like that. Mm-hmm. They were just starting to come out and kind of ease into mainstream radio at that time. But we thought, man, we saw them. We thought they was the hottest thing since sliced bread.
That's when Maggot Brain
because they were nonconformists just like us.
Yeah.
So that's what we loved about that, you know, about Parliament Funkadelic, because we saw some of us in them, you know. Yeah.
Let's pause and listen to the B-side of Ebony Rhythm Band's debut single. This is Drugs Ain't Cool, released by Lamp Records in 1969.
A little bit of weed is all I need. A little bit of weed is all I need. I'm getting high. I'm getting high. One little bit is all I need. Two little bit.
That was the Ebony Rhythm Band with Drugs Ain't Cool, released by Lamp Records in 1969. Let's return to our conversation with Ebony Rhythm's Pam Tanner Davis, Ricky Jackson, and Lester Johnson.
Your band eventually left Indianapolis because, I think, for a variety of reasons, one of which, though, was you were hitting a wall with audiences here, right? There wasn't a large audience willing to accept your sound. Tell me how the sound went over here. We were actually
starting to win a few people over because of our uniqueness and stuff. But it wasn't the reason we left was because we figured that there wasn't anywhere else to go from here. We had already played some pretty big venues when we were still, like, at the Coliseum. We had done that with
Bobby Womack.
And we had done these other kinds of things. We had done the thing
at Isaac Hayes over in Dayton, Ohio.
We had done that with
Earth,
the Stylistics.
Fire, when our single, How's Your Wife, was number one on the local markets.
Yeah.
So we had done, we left, and everybody thought we were crazy. Because we left with one gig.
Yep.
Am I right?
Yeah.
At the Peyton Place. That's all we had. One gig. But we said we're going to leave. And when we get out there, we're going to forge our way. And we're not coming back until we have a record deal. Because we knew hanging around here, the probability of that happening was not that great.
You know, we were already top of the heap anyway because we were the house band for Lamp Records. And we could have gone on and doing that indefinitely.
But, for years, yeah.
Yeah, but there was nowhere else to go. And we wanted to go national. We just didn't want to go. A lot of the groups here were content to be the big fish in the little pond. Well, we want to go beyond that. We've seen these national acts, and we thought this is what we want to do.
Yeah.
I do want to ask you about Lamp Records in depth here in a moment. But first, I want to ask about the history of funk music in Indianapolis. I think you were the first group to adopt the term funk in a real meaningful way within your music. I know there was a group called Funk Street Workshop.
Funk Incorporated.
Funk Incorporated had started.
It all came after.
Tell me, who was the first funk band you guys ever heard in Indianapolis? What was the kind of birth of this music here? You guys were obviously on the ground floor of that, but were there other groups you were hearing? Were the Highlighters, the Presidents? Did you consider that funk?
They were doing what, to me, I don't want to make it offending, but to me they were doing what I would call novelty R&B. Songs that were created for like little certain dance, like the Humbug. They make these little, I call them dance-oriented novelty songs. We had no interest in that. I mean, that I can recall, we wanted our exposure. We were, oh heck! I remember that one of the things that had kind of influenced us was hearing pure funk, Roger Holloway and
Asher Ben Ruby,
and they had a group called Pure Funk. They weren't really funk. They were rock, but they had some funk elements, and I think that was the only funk-type group.
Yeah,
I remember being at that time that I remember was Asher and those guys.
Which eventually became Roadmaster, correct?
Some of the members split off.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when Toby and them joined the band, it became Roadmaster. But other than that, I don't think there was anybody around here before us.
Pam, Ricky, anything you want to add to that? The development of funk
music? Covered it all,
From what I recall, they were mostly cover bands. I mean, they were pretty much straight R&B cover bands, you know. Not really a funk band, you know, per se. So, yeah, he's about right.
Don't touch that dial. Echoes of Indiana Avenue will return with more words and music from the Ebony Rhythm Funk campaign after this short break. This is Butch Slaughter, and you're listening to the Echoes of Indiana Avenue. This is the first episode of our three-part series focusing on the legendary Naptown band Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign. Their vocalist, Pam Tanner Davis, made her first recording as a member of the Pearls, an Indianapolis-based girl group. The Pearls released their debut single on Lamp Records in 1970. The recording featured backing from the Ebony Rhythm Band. Let's listen. This is the Pearls with Can I Call You Baby? That was the Pearls with Can I Call You Baby, released by Lamp Records in 1970. That recording featured instrumental accompaniment from Ebony Rhythm Band. The Pearls vocalist Pam Tanner Davis later became lead vocalist for Ebony Rhythm. WFYI's Kyle Long recently spoke with Ebony Rhythm's Pam Tanner Davis, Ricky Jackson, and Lester Johnson. Let's return to our conversation as they discuss the group's work with Lamp Records and their relationship with the label's founder, Herb Miller.
And I do want to ask about Lamp Records, which plays a big role in the group's history.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you guys, Lester and Ricky, I know you had a sort of up and down relationship with Lamp through the years at various points, I think, early on. Pam, I know you had a real tight relationship with Lamp Records. You told me one time Herb Miller was a family friend.
Yes.
And you signed to the label as a member of the Pearls. And yeah. You also worked as a receptionist for Herb and worked in his record
in
store,
his record
Good Vibrations.
Store. Sure
Herb
did.
Miller, founder of Lamp Records. Tell me your kind of relationship with Lamp, what that meant to you to be a part of this label. Any thoughts you want to share on your history with Lamp Records? Pam, why don't you start? Because you have a lot of information to share about Lamp.
Well, no, because like I said, Herb Miller was a family friend. My mom and dad knew him and his wife. They were friends, you know. And so that's how, you know, that's kind of how I got hooked up with Herb Miller. I don't know, you know, we recorded the song there, you know, for his label. And I did work in his record store, you know. So we always had a really good relationship, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, with Lamp.
I think it was a great opportunity for us.
Yeah,
because it allowed us to try to do some recording,
which we had never done before. Mm-hmm.
You know, and at that point here we are 16, 17 years old, and we're gonna get to go record music, mm-hmm. and so yeah. we've been doing it for a few years. It was like, wow, this is really great.
Yeah. He was a springboard. He really was a vital springboard. Because when I think about the things he did for us, he gave us the opportunity. Because I was telling the camera person here about how we used to be at Lamp Records, and they were bringing in these singing groups, and they would sing, and we would try to figure what key they were singing in. Then the next day, we would cut the record at Oma Studio. Then they bring in some more groups, and they would sing, and the next day, we would go to Oma Studio, and we would cut another. And that was so we got the van. It was leased. Well, we had a 1970 Ford Econoline van that was specially equipped with a carrier that was welded to the truck to put our PA equipment in, and he had air conditioning installed.
And a bed seat, so all four
bed seats, so we could all get crowd in there with all of our gear, and we had a big old peace symbol on the side of the van about that big. And none of the bands here locally had anything like we had. We had the nicest equipment. We used to piece it all together, as you remember.
At times, yeah.
We had three PA systems, and we would wire it all together. Old Bogan stuff, Atlas horns, custom PA. We would wire all that stuff together, and we would plug in these mics. And surprisingly, it sounded better than anything anybody else had at the time. And so we were kind of like, so I think some of the other bands were actually envious of us.
but all in all, Lamp was a good store for us.
It really was. It really was. Herb helped
us
a lot.
Awful lot. You know?
And He gave us an opportunity to create,
yeah,
not just for ourselves, but we got to create for the Vanguards and these other groups, the Pearls, too. Can I call you?
Right, right.
So you released your debut single on Lamp Records, Soul Heart Transplant, Drugs Ain't Cool. Was that 69 or 70? I'm never quite sure.
That was actually, I think, 69.
69.
And as you mentioned, you also backed some of the vocal groups on Lamp, including Pam's group, the Pearls, the Monteeks, and the famous Vanguards.
Right.
And you, in 71, played on the Vanguards' It's Too Late for Love, which became a Billboard Top 40 hit. Tell me about, this was like probably the biggest exposure Ebony Rhythm Band had had at that point, no? Getting on this, backing the group on the Top 40 single? Tell me about that.
Recording-wise, it was, I think, as far as live gigs, I think Isaac Hayes
But we got exposure because of the Vanguards.
Right.
Because he was in Detroit. We played behind, we was on a show with Jackie Wilson.
That's right. Oh, I won't never forget about the Jackie Wilson experience.
You know, so that was a lot of different shows that we were allowed to be on. Right. So it was a good exposure for the band, you know.
Phelps Lounge.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I don't remember the name.
It was Phelps Lounge. And you remember Jackie Wilson had a penthouse on the top floor. And we
you
didn't
got
have
too much detail.
No, hold on. This is stuff people
yeah, he's got a memory. He's got a memory like an elephant.
Phelps, the owner of Phelps Lounge, did not pay us. And we were broke, and we had a hotel bill, and we didn't have just enough money for gasoline. And Jackie Wilson had a penthouse on the top floor of this hotel, and Jackie Wilson paid our bill for the hotel, and he bought us food. Remember, he bought us a big old box full of sweet potato pies and ribs. And the other guy, who was a trumpet player that was with us just for that gig, he lent us enough money to get gasoline to get back home from Detroit.
Play saxophone. I don't remember who it was.
Maybe it was sax. I can't think of this guy.
I'm not sure.
Anything you guys want to say about the Vanguards? This was sort of the star group of Lamp at the time. And
I mean, me and Vizel, I knew Vizel well, and I loved all those guys.
I know, me too. Yeah, me too. Because the Pearls got to go on shows with, you know, with them too, got to be put on their bill, you know, with them too, which gave us exposure as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the Vanguards were poised to become an enduring group in soul music, like the Delphonics or some of those groups.
Yep.
But Lamp kind of started to
they absolutely
crumble for whatever reasons. What did you make of that? Because the label had so much potential. At one point, it was poised to really
distribution.
Explode.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know at the time, but later on, I figured out why it didn't. Was because of distribution. Yeah. Back then, if one of the big major labels did not pick you up, and they, you know, they had what's called rack jobbers. Well, if the rack jobbers didn't distribute your product through like the these big five labels that controlled everything, and that's what happened to them, they didn't get. They didn't get these deals with these rag jobbers, so they couldn't get distribution out to where people wanted it. So we would it just kind of got Chicago, Louisville, Indianapolis, the Midwest. Yeah. There were people that wanted music in L.A. and Ontario and New York, but because the rag jobbers, I didn't know anything about that stuff then. Mm-hmm. But later on, I figured out the reason that I found out why it never got to be. It was distribution. It was just all kind of like payola.
Who you know? Well, that's
and that's sad. That's what's really so sad about it, you know, because they could have really been really big group. They could have done. They could have done a lot of really big things because they had all the elements there.
Let's pause and listen to the Vanguard's 1970 hit, It's Too Late for Love, featuring instrumental backing from the Ebony Rhythm Band.
Will there be another chance for me? Surely somehow, some way must be.
You were such a fool.
But I'll be around to wait and see. Oh, it seems late, too late for love.
You should have been
That was the Vanguards with It's Too Late for Love, released by Lamp Records. That song featured instrumental backing from the Ebony Rhythm Band and became a top 40 Billboard R&B hit in 1970. In the early 1970s, Ebony Rhythm left Indianapolis for California, where they were hired to perform with the Indianapolis psychedelic gospel act, King James Version. Let's return to our conversation with Ebony Rhythm's Pam Tanner Davis, Ricky Jackson, and Lester Johnson.
It was. But then, like I said, at the end of that 1969, like 70, I guess that's when we started trying to expand the band a little bit.
Well, we were backing up. Really, part of it was we started backing up the King James Version.
Oh, yeah.
So that was how we got to L.A. To that club.
Oh, yeah, back in early 71.
Because the owner of the club heard us at the 20 Grand. It used to be on the corner of 34th and Illinois. Mm-hmm. And he heard us, and he heard the King James Version. He saw these guys running up walls, and they were quoting scriptures out of the Bible and smoking weed. And they were crazy.
So and they loved it.
Yeah, and right. The crowd loved it.
We want you guys to come to California and do this out here.
They want to do the show. So we went out there to back them up. Yeah. The problem was with the King James Version was that they had this great, powerful, convincing show. But once you saw it, you saw pretty much everything that they did.
That they had to offer.
So after, about 3 or 4 weeks, he let them go, and he kept us. And we stayed on as the house band for quite a while.
About two or three more weeks.
Mm-hmm. No, it was longer than that, I think. It was maybe a couple of months.
And that air to breathe. Try Jesus' love. Try it.
The King James Version recorded their first and only single after parting ways with the Ebony Rhythm Band. Let's hear an excerpt from 1971. This is He's Coming, featuring an unknown backing group.
We sing about the master.
Yes, we do.
In a
funky kind of way.
We sing about the master in a funky kind of way.
Ain't nowhere in the book say you can't do the funky chicken.
This is Butch Slaughter, and you're listening to the Echoes of Indiana Avenue. Tune in next week for the second episode of our three-part tribute to the Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign. And we'll end this week's show with a classic track from Ebony Rhythm's 1973 self-titled debut album produced by Wayne Henderson of the Crusaders. This is the Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign with Get It On.
Now let's talk about us fortunate people.
That's all the time we have for this week. Thank you for joining us for this tribute to the Ebony Rhythm Funk Campaign. You can meet me here on the Avenue again next week, same time, same place. And you can find the Echoes of Indiana Avenue podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you download your podcasts. Echoes of Indiana Avenue is written and produced by Kyle Long and hosted and co-produced by me, Herman Butch Slaughter.
Nobody knows on uptown, baby, like I do. Nobody knows on that town, baby, like I do. Do. If you will stop and listen, I will tell you a thing or two.